Bird flu, H5N1. There's an outbreak. Here's what you need to know. I'm going to break it down for you. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, back with, looks like we're back on viruses for just a touch. H5N1, I've gotten a lot of questions from people about this. Do we have to worry about it? How big of a deal is it? Is this mysterious disease X that we've been warned about? I'm going to go through all of this because it's really important that we understand that. Let's start here with your update for May 3rd, 2024. Now, this map shows where the outbreaks have been detected so far in the red states. That's where H5N1 has been detected. I'm going to break down what H5N1 is so that you understand it as well as you need to, because that's how I roll. I'm going to bring the receipts, going to save you time, do all this research, think about it, condense it. And I'm a show me state kind of guy. Wasn't born in Missouri, but I should have been, because I like to see how things connect. I'm trying to connect things all the time. So we'll do that for you here today. 9 states so far, and quote, H5N1 fragments were found in 20% of commercial milk. These are fragments. This is not live virus that they found in there. Very important to push that out there. Recent evidence indicates that samples contain no live virus when pasteurized. So that's something we need to talk about. Now, you've probably seen there's tons and tons of headlines currently around this H5N1 outbreak, and it actually could be a big deal. This isn't a big deal yet, but it could be a big deal. But our response to it, the government's response, I should say, now that is a big deal that's going to have huge impact. So we should be aware of that. And I'll bring those to your attention in just a second. So yeah, pasteurized milk, they say, is safe. They found it in beef and dairy cows, and they are testing the beef from those dairy cows. They haven't found any there yet. Now, why H5N1? Why is it such a big deal? Well, because there are different flavors of H5N1. So there's some very bad versions of this thing out there. And here are some of them where we see, looking across the different countries across many years, this is all the recorded cases so far, human cases of H5N1 from 2003 to 2024. So we have a 21-year span here. And you can see that there have only been 889 cases. Yeah. Not that many cases. However, 463 deaths. So that's like a 52% case fatality rate. And you can see it varies a lot. Some places had very high mortality. Some didn't have a lot. But this is 889 cases over 21 years. Hardly any to speak of. In the places where we saw these fatalities, they tend to come from a cluster of countries. None of these particular fatality rates have been seen anywhere in the United States or Europe or any place like that. Very rare, very sporadic outbreaks. Doesn't really seem to spread around a huge amount. I mean, you had that big outbreak in Egypt at one point. You had a big outbreak in Indonesia. But again, still just 300, 200 cases out of tens of millions of people. So H5N1, what is it? It is an influenza virus. Remember the flu? We used to get that pre-COVID. Now we only seem to get COVID for reasons, but flu has a very specific construct, and it's, again, an RNA virus. It comes from something called the Orthomyxidae family, and the influenza viruses have 8 separate RNA reading chunks, so 8 different chunks of the RNA, which, by the way, they can scramble those up and around for high mutagenicity. That's why typically the flu virus vaccine, when they produce it, they kind of have to wait to see which mix and match is most prevalent, and then they gear a vaccine against that. That's why the flu virus vaccines tend to be kind of not all that effective. They're only against a single mix and match, and second, which has a limited prevalence. It's not 100%. And second, it may have mixed and matched itself even before the whole manufacturing process for the vaccine has gone through its process. So of the things we want to note here, some designations. You see the HA and the NA, and we have M2, M1, then the PB1, PA, PB2. Those are the different chunks of RNA that come out. And so we have the neuraminidase, which is the NA, and the hemagglutinin, which is the HA. That's the H in the H5N1, and that's the N in the H5N1, H and N. And there's, it, you know, there's many, many different types of H's and many, many different types of N's. So you could have H7, N5, things like that. So H5N1 is a very specific combination or recombination of the influenza virus. In this case, an H5N1 is classically called a bird flu. H5N1, it's a subtype influenza A virus, they say here. And so Ortho Myxoviridae, and the genome involves 8 negative sense single strands of RNA. Negative sense meaning it gets read backwards rather than forward. So it has to be read backwards first, and then they can make proteins off of that. Abbreviated as PB2, PB1, all those other things, right? HA codes for hemagglutinin, as we discussed, an antigenic glycoprotein found on the surface of the influenza viruses. That's responsible for binding the virus to the cells, because that's step one. Then you have step two, you got to get into the cells. Step three, you get your proteins manufactured by the cell. And step four is you got to get back out of the cell, dumped and released so that you can continue your life cycle, if we call it that. And that's where neuraminidase comes in. The NA codes for neuraminidase. And that is an antigenic glycosylated enzyme found on the surface of the influenza viruses, and it facilitates the release of progeny viruses from the infected cells. So those are the basic components. So that's what we're talking about. It's another virus. It's got some RNA inside of it, just like COVID does. However, it's got a very different life strategy than COVID. It has a highly variable genetic structure, and it mixes and matches that up all the time to be highly mutagenic, to, you know, play the cat and mouse game of escaping the immune function. Now, that cat and mouse game has been going on for a very, very long time. Let's talk about this particular outbreak right now, because it's got some interesting signs and there's some concerns that we have to talk about. First, the CDC, we have this paper that came out. There's some very good vets on there. One of them, S. Timmermans down there, who has come to a honey badger event here at our farm for our Peak Prosperity yearly gathering. So met Simon and wrote this great paper here. It's highly pathogenic. The H5N1 clade 2.3, 0.4, 0.4B. So, you know, with COVID, we got used to all the different variants, right? And the variants went by scary names. We had Delta and Omicron and all that. But really, they had a bunch of numbers, clade numbers, right? And so clade, no difference. This is just virology, same as for COVID, only this time it's a flu virus, an influenza virus. Clade 2.3.4.4b. Now that virus is infected in domestic dairy cattle and cats. We're going to talk about that because that's kind of an important feature here. First thing they note in their abstract from that paper, they report that there is a highly pathogenic avia influenza A virus circulating around in dairy cattle and cats in Kansas and Texas, where they studied the genetics for this particular paper, which reflects the continued spread of that clade 2.3.4.4b viruses that entered the country sometime in late 2021. Put an asterisk on that entered the country part. Just hold on to that idea for a second. Infected cattle experienced nonspecific illness, reduced feed intake, they weren't that hungry, and rumination, oops, they weren't digesting all that well, and an abrupt drop in milk production, but fatal systemic influenza infection developed in domestic cats. Cow-to-cow transmission appears to have occurred, so this is important because this is an avian flu virus. It's supposed to transmit between birds easily. That it's transmitting between mammals is a point of concern in this particular story. So cow-to-cow transmission appears to have occurred. Why? Because infections were observed in cattle on Michigan, Idaho, and Ohio farms where avian influenza virus-infected cows were transported. I should note that in private conversations that the epidemiology doesn't seem to support the idea that this was potentially infected humans traveling from point A to point B, or they couldn't find a bird transmission vector. So it appears to be that it was cow to cow. So that's critical because now we have mammal to mammal transmission. Carrying on from that same paper, in February of 24, veterinarians were alerted to a syndrome occurring in lactating dairy cattle in the Panhandle region of northern Texas, that same Panhandle region that just had those horrible fires. They're not having a lot of luck in that region right now, however we look at that. Non-specific illness accompanied by reduced feed intake and rumination, an abrupt drop in milk production developed in the affected animals. The milk from most affected cows, interestingly, had a thickened, creamy yellow appearance, similar to colostrum, that first milk that lets down after pregnancy and birth. So something's, it's really hitting the mammary tissue pretty hard and is causing a pretty abrupt change. And also, if by hitting the rumen, the rumination piece as well, suggests that, you know, however that rumination environment in that sac is contained, something is wrong with how that's progressing as well. So maybe it's upsetting the secretions into that environment as well. Don't know yet. I haven't heard anything about why the rumination is affected. Just theories. So on affected farms, the incidence peaked 4 to 6 days after the first animals were affected. So whoosh, swept right on through. 4 to 6 days, all the animals get infected that are going to get infected, tapers off within 10 to 14 days. Most animals slowly return to regular milking. Everything seems fine. So the cows are mostly fine. Clinical signs most commonly reported in multiparous cows during middle to late lactation, plus 10 to 15% illness and minimal death. So the cattle aren't dying from this thing. So that's a very good sign. Okay. Now, what about this? As well, from that same paper, they, we have that this idea that it was this clade of 2344B. Spillover detections and deaths from this clade have been reported, from this very clade, have been reported in both terrestrial and marine animals, mammals, in the United States. I believe that was sea lions or was it seals? And maybe dolphins, I forget. But anyway, marine mammals and terrestrial mammals, the detection of this HPAI, the highly pathogenic avian influenza, that's HPAI, this H5N1 clade virus in severe cases of human disease in Ecuador and Chile raises further concerns regarding the pandemic potential of specific HPAI viruses. So that's a problem. And this is actually concerning because more than half the cats on a farm, a given farm, died after drinking milk from cows infected with bird flu. This is a May article from PhysOrg. We don't have any direct evidence that these cats actually died from this virus. It's suggestive, but we don't have that. That's, this is kind of a, they're making a stronger case here than I think the data we have. It's possible, but I haven't seen the data for that yet that would say this is 100% true, that it was because they got this virus from the milk and that's why the cats died. It's possible. It's suggestive, but we just have this one incidence showing up at this point in time. So I'm less clear how far out on a limb I want to go over that particular statement. Now, here's what's interesting. We don't have to go all that far back to, this is in USA Today. This is from May of 2015, right? When we were all naive and innocent before we understood that maybe sometimes labs are busy creating these chimeric viruses and doing funky things and that sometimes their people are working there. And they're a little sloppy because they're humans. It's Monday. They were hungover. Something happened. The maintenance budget was less than it should have been. So the gear wasn't swapped out as often as it should have been. You know, humans, right? So we find from this 2015 article that records obtained by USA Today showed they had 10 big incidents discovered at the nation's biolabs. They showed hundreds of incidents actually have occurred in biolabs across the country in recent years. And here's the first one. Respirator hoses fail in deadly flu experiments. Equipment failures of air purifying respirators potentially exposed workers to the deadly H5N1 strain of avian influenza during separate incidents in June and September of 2014 at the USDA's Southern Poultry Research Laboratory in Athens, Georgia. That's the Spurl, S-P-R-L. And they had to freedom of information that out, of course, because nobody, it's not like the government has any obligation to tell you when they're being sloppy and careless and almost created a big giant oopsie, right? They're going to hide that. And if you're lucky, you can FOIA that out anyway. So that's what they got out. So this is worth exploring. From that same article as well, we found out that in November of 2013, a University of Wisconsin researcher at a BSL-3 lab punctured skin with a needle loaded with H5N1 avian influenza. They were quarantined for 7 days in an empty home, and they moved the family out to an apartment, and nothing happened from that case. But it just points to the idea that these things can happen. And so the first question that we would have is, well, did anything like that happen here? So I'm going to explore that for just a second, because we need to know these things. And by the way, for any potential journalists out there, or congressmen or congressional researchers, I'll tell you the questions you should be asking right now. It's very simple. Can we prove that the genetics of this particular outbreak did not come from a lab? What were the specific genetics that the labs were working on? We need to know these things. And this goes back to 2015. Now, here's a great article by John Leake and Nicholas Hulsher in the Courageous Discourse Substack, which is a Peter McCullough Substack there. John Leake works with Peter McCullough all the time. So good article, really nicely done. This is back from April 18th. They wrote here, the USDA collaborating. Stop me if you've heard this one before. The U.S. government has been collaborating with Chinese researchers to monkey around with a virus that, oopsie, got away from them. The USDA has been collaborating with the Chinese Academy of Sciences to mutate H5N1 bird flu serial passage through mallard ducks, Chinese geese, and Japanese quail species since April 1st, 2021. Well, that's interesting. It's just data. I think we deserve to know that. In two related research projects, that second one, 440252, we'll take a closer look at that, titled Exotic and Emerging Avian Viral Diseases Research, USDA team research leader Daryl Kapsinski notes they did this stuff, the in vivo serial passaging of viruses. This is how you can create a gain-of-function experiment. Serial passaging speeds nature up. You don't have to invent anything. You take the H5N1 you got, and you go ahead and you start running that through cell lines and animal models. And so instead of this H5N1 having to, you know, go through one potential mutation cycle every year, you can shorten that up and have it go through growth cycle after growth cycle after growth cycle on a daily, weekly basis, really speed that up. And they do this because they want to, they're just curious about these things. Let's take a look at that right now. So this is that research project 440252. This is out of the USDA. It's a research project. You can see in yellow right there, it says it's US, UK, China collaboration. And so they're looking here for predictive phylogenetics for evolutionary and transmission dynamics of newly emerging avian influenza viruses. Start date, April 1st, 2021. You know, what's pretty fascinating about this, they say here that, just above the yellow, see that line? It says, the resulting information will be used to inform and parameterize, parameterize the models generated by collaborators. Dude, we're just trying to inform and parameterize some models of ours. You know, anyway, in yellow, this work describes a series of experiments designed to assess the effects of innate and adaptive immunity on evolution of AIV in vitro and in vivo. The unifying approach is to examine how virus strains from the H5NX, that could be N1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, how the H5NX series, especially clade 2, 3, 4, 4, especially clade 2, 3, 4, 4. Where have I heard about that clade? Oh, that's our current outbreak right now. H7N9 and H9N2 lineages, which pose the greatest current risk to both animals and humans, how they change the quasi-species level under various selective pressures and host switches and host immunity and competition, and virus competition. So they're actively experimenting with, can we get these things to jump species, and how do they do that, and what really happens? And it's all under the idea of saying, you know, if we study these things, we'll just know them better. That's cool. Unless you're doing things that nature wouldn't have done all on its own, and oopsie, it gets away from you. Then it would not be an awesome thing. COVID, right? I mean, do we have to cover this? I'm telling you, these virologists are scary crew, how they think and how they do their own personal risk-benefit analysis. You know, the risk to humanity is a giant contagious pandemic, but the risk to me is not getting a paycheck. I'm going to have to go with the paycheck on this one. That's how they roll. They say, we will use in vitro and in vivo systems as complementary approaches that allow virus evolution to be interrogated at relatively high throughput. Speed this up. Let's speed this up. Let's interrogate it. What are you doing? At tissues levels and at lower throughput, but in the whole organism level. Okay, that's what they were doing. That's kind of weird, right? Their approach, obviously, they say they're using tracheal organ cultures, so they're doing it in cell models. And as well, they say, secondly, in vivo, that means in whole animal, they're going to passage the viruses through mallard ducks, Chinese goose species, to predict evolution in natural hosts. And thirdly, viral evolution and transmission dynamics of avian influenza virus, that's AIV, infection in Japanese quail. Why? As an indicator species of potential to jump into mammalian hosts. So, you know, it was 2021, they started asking the question, what would it take for H5N1 to jump out of birds into mammals? And oopsie, all of a sudden in 2023, it looks like we had this outbreak happen where, next thing you know, this bird flu H5N1 is getting into cows and potentially cats. So, kind of interesting. You know what's really interesting? Looking at this paper in Science Direct, it says, you know, there were three distinct introductions of H5N1 clade 2344B into the United States from December of 2021 to April of 2022. December 2021, when did this start? Oh, April 2021. In December of 2021, look, this is clade we're worried about here, this 2-4. I'll get my highlighter out. When we're worried about this clade 2-3-4-4-B, and here this in yellow is the USA, and in blue we got Canada, and red is Europe, and green is Japan. And I think you might notice that this clade is pretty heavily, it's really only coming out of one place. In December of 2021, the U.S. Well, that's weird. Just wanted to point that out. Now, the U.K., of course, immediately swings into nanny state action. And one of the first things they wanted to do, because, of course, they are very interested in controlling food and food production. You know, we've been hearing articles for the past year about how gardening causes heart attacks, and maybe gardening contributes more to climate change than eating agro food. And we've been hearing about how Ireland needs to cull 200,000 cows, create a lot of cow death because cows fart, and that contributes to climate change. And next thing you know, hop, skip, and a jump, and you got the UK going, well, now you got to register to be a keeper of less than 50 poultry or other captive birds, according to this lovely nanny state form, IRA 82. And it says here that you, if you keep 50 birds or more, you must complete the compulsory registration form. That's number IRA 81. 82 is a little voluntary, but if you have 50 or more, you are breaking the law if you do not register 50 or more birds. Now, this is a little old. I pulled this down off of their website, but it's old because they didn't update it for something that happened back just in the beginning of April. So, yeah, you can't always get your government forms, your IRA 82s. You can't get those updated on a website. That takes seconds for a competent person. I run a website, so I know it doesn't take much. At any rate, in the Telegraph, they wrote, chicken owners will need to register with the government or risk a 5,000-pound fine under new rules to combat bird flu. How does registering a chicken combat bird flu? Well, let's find out. All poultry and captive bird keepers will be required to register their birds from October 1st, the government has said. Under previous rules, only flocks of 50 or more birds had to be registered. Keepers will now have to provide contact details, how many birds from which species are kept, as well as where and for what purpose. You got to fill out all this information. If you have one backyard chicken, you got to fill out this big old form and tell them the species and where it's kept and what you use it for. Like, dude, it's chicken. What do you think I use it for? Eggs and meat. It's a chicken. Owners who fail to register their birds face a maximum fine of £5,000 or 6 months in prison. Because, yeah, that's definitely something you would want to deprive somebody of their physical liberty for, because they didn't notify the government, the nanny state, about the fact that they had a chicken. Clearly, that's worthy of depriving somebody of their physical liberty. I could see that. Makes a lot of sense. You wouldn't want to pass a law without an imprisonment angle on it, because, you know, what kind of law is it then? Well, it's just a law, that same kind of law you might use for your lawmakers then. That's not fair. It follows a consultation with most respondents favoring keeping the existing regulations, with just 13% backing the change to registration for one bird or more. So why have the consultation? You have the consultation. 87% said, nah, bro, we don't want that. And so you just pass it anyway. But we had the consultation. We asked, you provided your feedback, and we just passed it anyway. This is such a sham. This is so, you could just feel, this is just terrible. This is coming. So tell you what, folks, you're going to have to get used to the idea that they are coming for everything you got. They want your freedom. They want your thought process. They want you to have pronouns. They want to raise your kids for you. They don't want you protecting yourself or fighting back against an assailant, even in your own home. They want you sick and subjugated. Just how they roll. Ye shall know them by their actions. Now, we have real trouble in the United States for dairy farmers. This is the rule that came out. This was a very, very quick rule, all at once, very fast. It was a federal order requiring testing for and reporting of highly pathogenic avian influenza in livestock. So, okay, here's this thing, gives cows a runny nose. They don't feel good. They got an upset tummy for a little while, and then they resolve. So immediately, the government has a rule that you have to test for them. Not just you have to test for them. Look at this. This is actually a big deal. First, this order from the government says the USDA has confirmed that this highly pathogenic avian influenza, HPAI, H5N1, clade 2344B, which we didn't have before 2021, when the Spurl started monkeying around with this stuff. Detections on 33 dairy cattle premises in 8 states, so it's pretty widespread at this point, and also in 8 poultry premises in 5 states, so that's Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Texas. So they say here, veterinary services laboratories have found HPAI in lung tissue sample from an asymptomatic cull dairy cow that originated from an affected herd and which did not enter the food supply. So found it in the lung tissue, not in the meat, but they found it in a cull dairy cow. A cull cow is a cow that it's no longer suitable for its milking purposes, and it gets culled, which means it gets sent off to the meat processing plant. And that's where most beef comes from for the average person. This isn't your hand-massaged, Wagyu, grass-fed, $50 a pound, serve it to the moneyed class right there down on Wall Street, right? This is the stuff you're buying at your Safeway and your Costco, right? This is ground beef. It comes, a big majority of that comes from cull dairy herds. So that's an important part of the story. There's a reason I gave you all that detail. HPAI has already been recognized as a threat by the USDA. And the interstate movement of animals infected with HPAI is already prohibited. So on the one hand, I'm okay with not having infected animals roaming hither and yon. That's fine if you want, but, you know, interstate lines is at least one border they can draw. Obviously, I don't think really infected animals ought to be moving off of an infected farm, depending on the infection that we're talking about. So I'm not against that idea just out of hand. However, when you throw a rule out like this, it's going to have a huge impact on the way things currently function, because they're talking about the interstate movement. The USDA is also so heavily regulated, the setting up of and the monitor and the operation and the monitoring of slaughterhouses, that most places those slaughterhouses have closed down and they're gone, and getting a new one started ain't in the cards. So we have more and more concentration of these slaughterhouses, and there's just a few, and they tend to be not in your state. So you take your cull cow and you segregate it off to the side, and you wait until you have a bunch of them segregated off. And then a truck pulls up from a segregate aggregator, and they put those cows into a truck, and they bring them off to another place where they got a bunch of cows, and they get enough of those, and they fill up a potbelly rig, and then that goes off to the slaughterhouse. And that's how this system works. that whole system is now broken. You can't do that under these new rules, which they came up with very quickly in this particular story. Okay, so what it means is that prior to interstate movement now, dairy cattle are required to have a negative test for influenza A virus at an approved National Animal Health Laboratory Network laboratory. Did they have enough capacity to do this? We have to test every animal. What happens if an aggregator brings an animal into one of these concentration lots before they ship them off to the meat plant, and then you find that you have one infected animal? Do you have to retest all the other ones? A lot of questions in this particular story. But what this is going to mean for the average person is that beef prices are about to go a lot higher, because this is going to be a very difficult. It's going to take a while to sort out how all this works, and it was a very quick decision that was made. One of the fastest federal rule changes, according to people in the biz, that they've ever seen. So it's almost like somebody was ready to have this particular regulation come out, or we're just a little faster at these things now because COVID, you know, and we're all just that much snappier about viruses and viral loads. But what they haven't shown, what the threat is to humans, there's basically none. One person has so far been tested positive for the H5N1. It was a worker at one of the infected factory farms or infected farms, and they had pink eye. They had got conjunctivitis. They got the pink eye. That's all that happened to them so far. This isn't one of those clades that jumps into humans currently and causes 50% mortality. It doesn't jump from human to human. We have no human to human transmission. That's good news. We barely have any cow to human transmission. In fact, it's really just in one dude's eye so far. Okay, the conclusions from this. What do we got? Let's start here. First, the attacks on eating meat they've been out there for a number of years. Those are actually helping to more rapidly progress the fight against H5N1. We're seeing rules come up. Nobody's asking any questions about what is this new rule set do to the affordability or availability of meat and meat products. Can we even show that there's any of this stuff in meat? And even if we could show there was some of this fragments of this H5N1 in meat, can we show that there's any human concern around that at this point in time? The answer so far is no, it doesn't matter. They just slapped all the rules on. And I believe part of the reason that that's easy to do is because we have an administration right now that is chock full up to its eyeballs with people who believe in shaping the narrative more than science. And if you can fit the science to make the narrative, man, you have an easier job out there. You get your paycheck, you get promoted, people like you. It's just part of it. So I think we've seen an overly aggressive, rapid response towards the safety side of this simply because it fits the narrative. It's not that it's necessarily strong science. The effects on beef prices, I think they're going to be dramatic within the U.S., and that's due to how the system operates, and it's because it's how do we even get enough of these tests, and the tests are going to slow things down, and there's going to be cases, you know, now where it's not going to be worth somebody's time or effort. Some farms are just going to say, you know what, I can't do this anymore. This could actually really be one of the final nails in the coffin for the dairy herd operations. And oh, wouldn't this be a surprising thing where an attack on the dairy herds in the United States leads to a collapse of many of the family farms out there, which are then, surprise, bought up by big industrial agricultural concerns who, surprise, are going to be able to comply more easily with all of these new government regulations. And surprise, wouldn't we all be surprised to find out that many of those same firms had been lobbying for the exact changes and rules that we just saw. Yes, I see a skeleton in every bush at this point in time. It's hard not to, after watching just how defective and statist and collectivist our fascist sort of U.S. government has become. And fascism, I'm using that term as the merger of corporation and state, right? Chickens. Well, they're on the chopping block. Backyard chickens. In fact, your backyard garden. You may have to register your veggie plants coming soon. I mean, you can feel this is all proceeding apace. We have to be aware of this because it's time to push back against these things. This is just silly. The whole idea that humans do not have a fundamental right to grow their own food is absolutely flawed. It's wrong. We got to roll that right on back. The whole idea that we're going to cede our control for growing food to these big corporations because they can comply with the rules that we've all decided are much more important and good for our food and health and safety. I mean, come on. If that were true, the United States wouldn't be the biggest metabolic walking disaster ever. We wouldn't have obesity rates that are over 30% in far too many states. We wouldn't have cardiovascular disease. We wouldn't have diabetes exploding through the roof. If we had a functioning regulatory oversight of a food system to give us better, high-quality, nutrient-dense food that wasn't killing us, we would not have the sickness we have in the United States that we currently have. So I don't, for one, want any more regulation of my food system. Thank you very much, because your brilliant oversight, USDA, FDA, etc., have brought us to the brink of metabolic disaster in the United States. So you failed, and I don't want to give you more power to fail. That would be like giving the WHO more power to regulate pandemics after they completely screwed the pooch on COVID, right? Nah, I don't reward failure. That's not how I like to do it. I prefer to do the opposite of that. So I'd rather not see chickens on the chopping block here. Now, carrying on, the timing of all this is really suspicious, because, like, where did this clade, you know, come from? Where did this, you know, 2, 3, 4, 4B thing come from? By the way, again, for congressional regulators or for any journalists out there, here is the operative question. Can we see the exact precise genetics of the experiments that were being conducted in these labs? Which exact genetics were they working with? And what's the similarity of those to the genetics of the current outbreak we're seeing? That would be a good question to ask, and I certainly hope somebody does. I'm not that worried about this H5N1. Pink eye doesn't worry me that much. It's not jumping around that much. It doesn't, you know, this is just something, if you said, wow, of the things I need to worry about this week, this month, this year, they're not on there. I am worried about how many other labs are out there sticking themselves with needles and having busted air hoses and doing who knows what by creating a lot of bizarre new Franken viruses out there. In part two of this for my subscribers, by the way, I go into that much more deeply. There's some very concerning stuff there you're going to want to know about. I'm going to give more context. I'm going to describe how to prepare just in case things do get worse out there for my subscribers. Peak Prosperity, that's what they pay me for. I am their information scout. It's what I love to do. And so I'm going to be talking about, is this what we're seeing in H5N1? Is this really part of the plan? Because we've got a Great Reset coming. We know they want the Great Reset. I don't know why they think they can manage the Great Reset without just breaking everything, including their own lives. But hey, we can all disagree about these things, but they're serious, dead serious about this, folks, and they're going to keep doing it until they break something. And I want you to be ready. I want you to be prepared. Step one is knowing what they're doing, having that context. Step two is getting past that activation barrier so you can begin to take actions to become more resilient. And then finally, you got to find your community of peeps. You got to talk about other people who are still capable of having reasonable, non-insane conversations about the things that matter most. And that's the community we have back at Peak Prosperity. So with that, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next time. Don't worry about H5N1 yet, but definitely keep one lid half cracked on this story. Bye-bye.